Just out of curiosity, how many people in this room have ever been on a cruise? How many people left on the cruise, embarked on either a Sunday, a Monday, or a Tuesday? How many embarked on a Wednesday? Thursday, Friday, I don't know. This is complicated. I want you to know that I gave a lecture on this topic. You know, our series is about halacha and travel in the Amic Learning Center. And honestly, it was very confusing, very complicated. So the first 10 minutes, we haven't started yet, but the first 10 minutes of today's presentation, what I'm going to try to do is summarize the highlights of what I gave at the Amic Learning Center. So you'll have the advantage of getting in 10 minutes what it took me an hour to try to transmit. And then we go on to our main topic for today, which is travel over the dateline. Okay, then? So that's going to be the agenda for today. There's a young rabbi who was rabbinated as the assistant rabbi out in L.A. His name is Rabbi Tzvi Goldberg. I don't know him personally, but he did a lot of research on this issue of taking a holiday at sea. And according to the halacha, when are you allowed to embark on this cruise? And he points out that before you decide to go on a cruise, you know, you may want to check out a few different things besides the question of what day of the week you're leaving on. And he gives you a list. He says there are issues about a cruise in terms of crossing the dateline, which we'll discuss in Ritz Hashem. And then a cruise that docks on Shabbos. Are you allowed to get off the cruise on Shabbos? He speaks about some of the complications of kosher supervision on a ship. He speaks about electric devices, which that's true for all hotels. And he speaks about issues of tznius, like, for example, mixed swimming, and so forth and so on. But that's not going to be the discussion that we have. You know, there are many issues about whether a religious Jew wants to take a vacation on a cruise, and whether or not that vacation is appropriate in terms of its atmosphere for a religious Jew. But we're going to discuss, just in the first few minutes of our Shia today, a Gemara Masechta Shabbos on Daf Yud Tes Amud Aleph. The Gemara there quotes a Braisa, which is Tanoic literature, so this is really important, that one is forbidden to embark on a journey on a boat less than 3 days before Shabbos. So that means within that 3 days before Shabbos, you're not allowed to embark on a ship. That's what the Gemara says. The Gemara doesn't exactly tell us why. The Gemara offers this as a rabbinic, what we call a shavus, meaning a rabbinic enactment for Shabbos, that we should make sure that we don't violate the Shabbos. And therefore, we have to make sure that we don't embark within 3 days of Shabbos. Now, when you think about it, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday are all within 3 days of Shabbos. Or shall we say no? We count Shabbos as well, and therefore it would start with Thursday, Friday, and it would end on Shabbos. That would mean that you're allowed to embark on the cruise on Wednesday. So this is one issue that's going to come up. But the real issue that I want to summarize for you and try to make this easier is, why did the Rabbanan tell us that you can't embark on a cruise within 3 days before Shabbos? And the Gemara itself doesn't address this issue. So if you don't see it in the Gemara, you have to go to the Rishonim, you know, the early commentaries. And amongst the commentaries, just give a low number of how many different explanations there might be. Maybe you in your own mind could understand why we don't want to embark on a cruise, you know, before, you know, after Wednesday. I don't know if anybody has any intuitive sense about that. What would be the problem of getting on a ship? How many different answers to this question are there in the Rishonim? 7 different answers. 7 different opinions. I can go through all 7 of them, but I'm going to make life easier for ourselves. Because in the poskim, in the final codes, only 3 out of the 7 were accepted. And those 3 are the Bala Ma'ar. His name is Rabbeinu Zrachi Alevi. The Rif, Rabbeinu Alfasi. Those were the 2 main opinions. And finally, the opinion of the Bali HaTosfos. So I'm going to just summarize these 3, because these are the 3 main opinions. And then what I want to do is take a few minutes to see if those halachic reasonings still apply today in contemporary life. Because after all, our discussion is about contemporary halacha. So we're going to start the shiur now, and we're going to start with the Bala Ma'ar. The Bala Ma'ar says that any time a ship embarks on a journey, we assume that there's some element of danger involved. And as a result of that danger, we may have to violate the Shabbos. Now, in a life-threatening situation, we will override the Shabbos. That's called pikuach nefesh. So for the sake of saving lives, we will override the Shabbos. But the halacha does not allow us to deliberately put ourselves into a situation where we know that due to danger we'll have to violate the Shabbos. There has to be some overriding reason why you would expose yourself to that possibility. So for example, says the Bala Ma'ar, if your journey is for the sake of a mitzvah, then we will allow you to embark on this journey despite the fact that we may have to violate the Shabbos, but that's because it's going to be a pikuach nefesh, it's going to be a life-threatening situation. But if you're simply going on a trip for the fun of it, shall we say, for the enjoyment and the pleasure of having a holiday, that, he says, is not enough of a reason to allow you to put yourself into a situation in which it would be necessary to violate the Shabbos. So again, just to summarize the first view as to why the Rabbanan prohibited this, is because you are deliberately exposing yourself to a high probability, statistically, of endangering your life, and therefore you'll have to override the Shabbos. Now, right away, yeah?
Crossing the road, as I said.
Yeah, some people would say that crossing the road, that's what I mentioned last time, you know, about when we were speaking about Tfilas HaDerech, and I asked the question as to whether or not a person who's flying, at what point does he say Tfilas HaDerech? And I said that the most important time to say Tfilas HaDerech is when you get into the cab on the way to the airport. But now you can say just crossing the road is itself danger. But whatever it might be, this is the Bala Ma'ar. Now the Bala Ma'ar asks himself the following obvious question. What difference does it make whether he embarks on a Sunday, Monday, or Tuesday, or on a Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday? In both cases, his intention is to travel over Shabbos. And the amount of danger doesn't seem to be in any way a reflection or caused by the day of the week that he leaves on. At the end of the day, he's going to have to violate the Shabbos if a danger arises. So the Bala Ma'ar here introduces a very interesting concept called Me'achorei HaShabbos. This has a ripple effect in Hilchos Shabbos. Me'achorei HaShabbos means that there's the backside, so to speak, the part of Shabbos that we already experience, but it projects itself beyond Shabbos. Do you follow? In other words, what he's saying is that for the first 3 days of any week, we are Me'achorei HaShabbos. We've already had the Shabbos behind us. And what does he mean that the Shabbos is behind us? Can anybody imagine a halacha where Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, the first half of the new week, belongs to the previous Shabbos? Oh. Excellent, Havdalah. Because the law is that if you didn't make Havdalah, Motzi Shabbos, we give you up to 3 days. That's the first half of the week. So the first half of the week is, so to speak, the back or the overlap of Shabbos, the extension of Shabbos. And he says at that point, the halacha doesn't require you to already think about next Shabbos. Your mental state is preoccupied with last Shabbos. But once you pass the first half of the week, it's no longer Me'achorei HaShabbos. Then the Bala Ma'ar says we have to already anticipate the Shabbos to come. And that is the second half of the week, which is attached to the next Shabbos, and he says, at this point, we have to begin to organize our life in such a way that we will fulfill the Shabbos properly. If we go out on a ship, knowing full well that we'll have to, or we may have to violate the Shabbos, he says we're too close to Shabbos. So that's the opinion of the Balamor. Okay? Now again, we're going to come back to contemporary life in just a minute. Let me just present the Shittos. Now we have a Shita of the Rif. And this is pretty famous. I hope all of you know about this. And that is that when a person travels by ship, as a result of the constant motion of the ship, people suffer from a certain kind of a sickness. We'll call it seasickness, if whatever name you want to give it. And he says, as a result, it undermines our ability to enjoy the Shabbos, which is called what? Oneg Shabbos. So because in the midst of Oneg Shabbos, we don't want to travel by ship. Once again, we have to ask the following question. We're talking about someone who's embarking on a journey that will take him over the Shabbos. So what difference does it make whether he leaves on a Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday? In both cases, he will upset his belly, so to speak, because of the constant motion of the ship, and therefore undermine his Oneg Shabbos. So the Rif answers that it takes a person 3 days of boat travel until he gets used to the boat. And at that point, he's so used to traveling in the constant motion that he will survive with in good health. And by the time he gets to Shabbos, he will now have passed those 3 days of boat travel. He got used to the constant motion and it will no longer undermine his Oneg Shabbos due to sickness. The third shita that I want to mention, which is accepted at one point by Tosfos, is that we are worried about what's called Tchum Shabbos. Now, Tchum Shabbos means the following, that if we find ourselves, as Shabbos enters, in a populated area, which is called the Yishuv, then we have to remain for the course of Shabbos within either the Yishuv itself, that populated urban area, or we can extend it up to what's called the Tchum Shabbos. The Tchum Shabbos, anybody know how long of a distance that is? Just testing you? Excellent, 2,000 Amma. So let's say it's a mile, or maybe more than a mile. And he says the following, the ship is no doubt going to travel more than that amount of Amos outside of the Yishuv. And therefore there's a problem of Tchum Shabbos. That's the opinion of one Tosfos. It's more famously known as the opinion of Rabbeinu Hananel, who is one of the Sephardic Rishonim. Now, at the end of the day, Tosfos rejects this opinion because he says that the prohibition of going out of the Tchum of Shabbos, out of the parameters of the city, more than 2,000 Amma, only applies when you're on the ground. The ground, halakhically, goes up, this is called Lavud, up to 10 Tfachim, which is a very narrow kind of thing. So that if the ship is in very narrow waters, which means it's below 10 Tfachim, then you might have a problem, as Rabbi Nachmanel points out, in going Chutz L'Tchum. But if the ship is traveling in water that's deeper than 10 amos, it's above your knees, then you don't have a problem with Tchum. So Tosfos says, I cannot accept Rabbeinu Hananel because there's no Tchum Shabbos above 10 Tfachim. How are large ships? You know, he says, all right, maybe if you're in a little raft, you know, traveling over a river, which according to the Rif might be okay because you don't suffer from seasickness, but if it's such a low boat that it travels through shallow water, then maybe you have a problem of Tchum, if it goes through a river that's 2,000 amos. But our ships, says Tosfos already 1,000 years ago, are above 10 Tfachim, they're not in this shallow water, they're in deeper water, and therefore there's no problem with the Rif. Therefore Tosfos offers a variant understanding of why there's a problem going on a boat. And he says that the issue is either what we call hashata, which means swimming. You know, we're not allowed to swim on Shabbos. And Tosfos makes this jump and he says that when you're traveling by ship, it's considered as if you're swimming. Again, Tosfos is going to have a problem. Again, what difference does it make if he leaves on Sunday, Monday, or Tuesday, which is okay, or he leaves on Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday? And then Tosfos offers another interpretation, which is again is very difficult, which is called a Carmelis. So I'm not going to get into this, it's an hour discussion, but a Carmelis is neither a public area nor a private area. It's public in the sense that it's accessible to anyone, but it's not private in the sense that it's not walled, it's not it's surrounded by walls that are 10 tefachim high. And the Rabbanan said that because a Carmelis looks like a public area, we're going to treat it as a public area, in which case you're not allowed to carry anything for Amos in a Carmelis. So if the ship is going through a sea, and a sea has the status of a Carmelis, therefore it's a matter of carrying. Now, I'm not sure what you're carrying in your pocket, but people go on a ship are carrying things, and that would be a problem of Carmelis. Once again, the issue is what's the difference if he leaves, if he embarks in the first half of the week or the second half of the week. Now, let's just fast forward to contemporary cruises. Let's go through the various opinions. Certainly, Rabbeinu Hananel, Chutz L'Tchum, is totally irrelevant. There are no cruise ships that will cruise through shallow water. It just doesn't happen. Then we have the Baal HaMor. The Baal HaMor is worried about the possibility or the probability of having to be Mechalel Shabbos if there's a danger, if there's a threat. Again, I don't know. You know, we know about the Titanic, but I don't know in the last 100 years, you know, how many ships have been. Back in the day, there was, you know, the ship could be capsized by a storm. Today, again, somebody could Google it for me as we speak and tell me what, you know, what percentage of cruise ships today face any danger and threat. I would think it's almost a negligible percentage. So I don't think the Baal HaMor would apply to our cruise ships. Now we go to the rif. This is really the, shall I say, the rub. This is really the main problem. Does the rif apply today to our cruise ships? Now, I personally have never been on a cruise ship. Those who have will answer the following question. Do you get seasick on a cruise ship? No. It's like you don't even know you're on a ship. Like you feel like you're on a hotel, in a hotel, on land. What? Some people do get seasick. Oh, that's the question. Now, let's assume, again, we're going with the Shita of the Rif, that the original prohibition about, you know, embarking on this journey, on this cruise, you know, close to Shabbos is because, you know, you'll suffer from seasickness. Let's assume that at the time of the Rif, it was, I don't know, let's call it 30%, 40%, I don't know, maybe 60% of the population would suffer at least some mild phenomenon or exhibit this seasickness. Today, let's say that the percentage went down to 5%. You know, maybe 1 out of 20 people will suffer from seasickness on these massive cruises. So what does Halacha say when there was an original enactment, which if the Chachamim were alive today, they would not institute this gezeirah because the percentages are so small, are so insignificant, that there's no need to concern ourselves with 1 out of 20 people that suffer from seasickness. So here we have a major issue amongst the poskim, the controversy that is still raging today. For example, Rav Avadya Yosef says we have to apply the principle of lo pluk, which means that once the enactment was made, even if the original reason would not warrant the initiation of that enactment, nevertheless the enactment remains binding. For example, we don't take pills on Shabbos. Again, there are 50 million exceptions to that rule, but the abstract concept is we don't take pills on Shabbos. Why? Because back in the day, you know, they used to they used to do what's called shchika samon, what's it called, a mortar and a pestle. You know, they used to make their own pills. Today, when was the last time you produced your own pill? But yet, we still don't take medicines today. That's called lo plut. So Rav Avadya Yosef wants to say that according to the Rif, the prohibition against embarking on a trip, on a cruise ship, within 3 days of Shabbos would still apply today, as long as you can testify that there's some even minuscule percentage of people who suffer from seasickness. Now, other poskim say that we still have to be careful about the original Isur according to the Rif because of the Bach. Now, the Bach lived only, you know, 450 years ago, but he had an insight. The Bach claims, and again, I'll ask you to Google this for me. Whenever I use the word Google, that means you check out the reality and the biology, because I don't know. And the Bach claims that seasickness is not a result of motion, although that's certainly a variable, but it's also a result of the quality of the air. And he says the air going overseas, you know, which is salty water, is a different quality of air. And that air could cause you discomfiture, if there's such a word in English, right? Not to be comfortable. And that itself, according to the Rif, would undermine your onyx Shabbos. And if we take the Bach, that, the, you know, no matter what the size of the ship, it could be a massive cruise ship, and I could argue that I feel like I'm on a hotel. I don't even know if it's a moving hotel. I have no idea. If you blindfold me and put me on a cruise ship, I wouldn't even know I was on a cruise ship. But nevertheless, the Bach says that the air quality is different. The atmosphere is different, and it has effect on the dizziness of a person, and it takes a good couple of days to get used to the air on a ship. This is the Bach writing 4.5 centuries ago. So basically, the whole issue now of whether or not a person could embark on a ship within the 3 days before Shabbos really boils down to the following. The argument of the the Rabbeinu Chananel is totally irrelevant. There are no cruise ships that dip below 10 tefachim, so that's not an issue. We don't have to worry about tchum. The issue of the Baal HaMor, again, is totally irrelevant. We're not talking about danger. We're not talking about the statistical probability of having to be Mechal Shabbos because of the ship. The whole issue boils down to the Rif. And the Shulchan Aruch seems to paskin like the Rif, that the reason why we don't embark on a journey within 3 days before Shabbos on a ship is because of seasickness. And here we have three opinions. One opinion says it's asur because of lo plug. Another opinion says it's asur because you can't leave within 3 days because of the Bach. And the third opinion says, no, there's no seasickness today, and then the original Gezerah has nothing to do with our ships, and therefore you're allowed to embark. So if you ask me, halacha l'maaseh, what you should do, I would say the following. The best advice I could give you, if you have to embark on a journey within 3 days before Shabbos, and we're going to rely here on the Vilna Gaon says that Wednesday is okay, because what happens is by the time you get to Shabbos, if you leave on a Wednesday, it's already been 3 days that you're on the journey. So he's going to count Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and then by the time he gets to Shabbos, he's already used to the motion of the ship. So you're allowed to leave on a Wednesday. If you want to know, can you embark on a Thursday? Then my recommendation would be find a mitzvah. What I mean to say is, find some sort of a way that you can justify leaving on a Thursday or a Friday because you're doing a mitzvah. Now, I don't know what that mitzvah is going to be. So you'll have to decide for yourself. In any event, we have another issue about a ship that will dock for a few hours. People leave the ship. They'll give you time to walk around the island, and that's on a Thursday or a Friday. So now what happens is that even though you embarked on a Sunday, Monday, or Tuesday, what happens is that on a Thursday or a Friday, you get off the ship and get back on the ship. Is that a problem? And again, you know this beforehand. They're telling you we're going to dock on the island. We're going to give you 8 hours to walk around and see the natives on the island. You know, for that period of time, on a Thursday, you're going to get back on the ship on a Thursday, or for that matter, on a Friday. And then you're in trouble with this sheet of the Rif, which we paskin like, that there's a problem of seasickness. So here the issue is the following issue. How do we view this, this period of time in which you disembark from the ship and then you get back on again? Is that a new journey that you're getting back on? You're starting on Thursday a brand new journey, and the halacha doesn't allow you to do that? Or do we say, no, this is not a new journey, but rather this is just an extension of the old journey? In other words, you're just taking a little bit of pause, but you really embarked on this journey on a Sunday, Monday, or Tuesday. And in this particular presentation, he quotes Rav Herschel Schechter, that Rav Herschel Schechter said, it's okay, you can get off the ship and get back on, it's not a new journey, and therefore even though it's on a Thursday or Friday, it's fine. Rav Schechter in general would discourage a person from getting onto a ship, it's just simply for the pleasure of going on a cruise, if it was a Sunday, Monday, or Tuesday, but If he leaves on a Sunday, Monday, or Tuesday, which is perfectly okay, knowing full well that he's going to disembark on a Thursday and get back on the ship on Thursday or on a Friday, that Rav Shechter says is okay because it's not a new journey, it's just an extension of the old journey. Any questions? Because I want to go on to the international dateline. Yeah.
It would seem that going back to the 4.5 centuries or however long before travel was what it was today, where we don't even think about what we do. We don't worry about ships. Thank God, we don't worry about ships sinking in the
water. Right, so the Balmar for sure is not going to apply.
In the days of the heavy, people didn't get on ships for pleasure 4 centuries ago. But you know, you had to make a business trip. It was part of your parnassi. You had to make that trip from Ada.
Right.
All of this also applies, I would guess?
So that's why I tell you the concept of L'shem Mitzvah is a very, I don't know if I could use the word ambiguous, a very, you know, there's such a gray area. You know, why am I going on this trip? You know, almost any answer you give me could be construed in some sense as a mitzvah. But I think what the Chazal say by mitzvah, what they meant was that as far as your business is concerned, and certainly your pleasure, organize it that you leave on a Sunday, Monday, or Tuesday. However, if there's an urgent mitzvah, like for example, let's say, you know, a rabbi is being called to another community because they have an issue that has to be determined. They need a posek. Or let's say, for example, back in the day, they needed what's called pinyon shvuyim. You know, they needed to gather funds and transfer the funds over to those captors in order to get the captives free. You know, that's a real dvar mitzvah. Others would say, no, you know, dvar mitzvah could be expanded. You know, let's talk about anything that I need for my psychological health, my financial well-being, you know. And then we have a broad scope as to a dvar mitzvah. I'm just telling you that I think if you have to embark on a cruise within 3 days before Shabbos, somehow convince yourself, or maybe your local Orthodox rabbi who's advising you, that there is some sort of pressing mitzvah that you need, and that's why you embarked on that cruise. I want to add one point here, and then I'll answer your question. There is an issue of what's called amira li'akum. Let me explain. We don't allow malacha to be done by non-Jews for the sake of Jews. Now, let's talk about piloting a ship. You know, the captain of the ship will no doubt be involved in various malachas. In fact, the very fact that he ties knots, for example, right? You know, if you want to tie down the ship to the dock or when they disembark or on a Shabbos, whatever it might be. There are various malachos that are involved in piloting a ship. Now, let's assume that the crew is purely non-Jewish, because otherwise you have a more serious issue if the Jews are piloting the ship. That could be real and will be real chil Shabbos. Can I go on a ship that's traveling on Shabbos, knowing full well that there are various malachas that are being done in order to pilot the ship? Well, the answer is these malachas are being done by non-Jews. But the problem is we have an Easter called Amira Li'akum. We're not allowed to organize it such that the guy does malacha for us. And by the way, Amira Li'akum should not be taken literally because I told the guy to do it on my behalf. Amira Li'akum means that the guy is doing it on my behalf. So certainly the crew is piloting the ship on behalf of the passengers that are traveling in that ship. If those passengers are Jewish, and certainly if you're on the crew, there's at least one on the cruise here, there's at least one Jew here, then he's piling it on behalf, he's doing these malachas on your behalf. So here we have a head to the Ramban. The Ramban, as you know, lived almost 1,000 years ago, and the Ramban says it depends. If we look at the passengers on the ship, where is the rove, where is the mean? Let's say there are 100 passengers on the ship. The rove, let's say, we'll call it 51 out of 100, are non-Jews. Says the Ramban, in that case, we assume that the pilot is working, is operating on behalf of the rov, of the majority, which in this case is non-Jews. So even though the Jewish population of the passengers on the ship is 49%, that's okay, says the Ramban. But once you cross over 51%, and that's the Jewish population, if the passengers on the crew, let's say for example it's a Jewish cruise, right? We're visiting a kosher cruise. So now, in contemporary life, I don't think the Ramban is so problematic for us. I'll tell you why. And again, if the Ramban would apply, then it wouldn't make any bit of a difference what day of the week you embarked on the cruise. Because even if you embarked on a Sunday, these malachas are going to be done for you on a Shabbos. But I don't believe that it's too practical. I'll tell you why. And again, tell me if I'm wrong, because I didn't Google this. When you go on a kosher cruise, I think what happens in most cases, maybe there are exceptions, is that the entrepreneur who organized the kosher cruise, he takes a designated number of cabins on the cruise for the kosher people who are joining the cruise. The majority of the passengers on the cruise are not Jewish, so the Ramban would allow that. But if you get to the point in which the kosher cruise has majority of passengers who are Jewish, then that is a very serious problem which I personally cannot solve. I don't have any solution to that problem. So again, you know, how the poskim are going to allow that to go on, I don't know. The only, again, I call it a dismal, distant possibility to allow such a cruise, which is going to travel on Shabbos, it's piloted by a non-Jewish crew, and the majority of the passengers are Jewish. The only light at the end of the tunnel, I think, is what's called autopilot. Have you ever heard of autopilot? Now, the truth is, you know, this is what Chazal called dok v'tishkach. I mean, it's listen to what I say and then forget it. It's not true. I'll tell you why. Autopilot is not all that it's cracked up to be. You know, you cannot have auto. As soon as the ship will hit winds or narrow areas, you know, where they have to pass by between mountains and so forth and so on, forget about autopilot. There ain't no such thing as autopilot. You have to have a crew of experts who are piloting the ship. They can't fall back on autopilot. So to say that, you know what, because the ship is operating on autopilot, and for a moment I don't even see, you know, the pilot, I don't see the captain of the ship, and therefore there's no malacha being done on my behalf, and we are the majority, the Jewish population of the passengers, the majority, that would be fooling myself, because chances are that under certain circumstances, the autopilot is not going to do the trick. It's not going to be reliable. There is a very, very serious percentage, statistically, of malacha that's being done by the crew, the non-Jewish crew, on behalf of the Jewish people, and they make up the majority. I don't know if autopilot is going to be the solution to that halachic issue.
Are you forgetting about...
I'm sure I forgot a lot of things, but just remind me.
I was a year old. I was the only one who didn't throw up on the boat. I was too young to throw up. But everyone threw up. Now, I'm going to check at home. I know there were a lot of Jewish people because we have a list of who was on the boat. But I'm going to...
Where was the boat traveling to?
We came to America.
Ah, to America. To Ellis Island?
I don't know how... Yeah.
Oh, I have so many jokes about that. Yeah.
I don't know how many days it took us. I know the other boat where we had our furniture also went down into the sea.
Oh my gosh.
We had two boats and one just went down.
Look, you had to go on the boat, but if, you know, today I would not encourage you taking a cruise on that boat. My sister was actually able to go to a library, which she found in the archives, a picture of the boat that my father came on from Lithuania to New York. But, you know, my favorite joke about that, about Ellis Island, is that this, you know, Yiddish-speaking Jew was, you know, he didn't know, they told him they could ask him his name when he comes, so they gave him a name, and when he got to, and they asked him his name, he said, "Oy, Fergesen, I forgot it." So they wrote him down as Ferguson. You know, that became his name.
He's got a job. Doesn't matter if there's 5 people on the boat or 5,000 people. Doesn't matter if it's Jewish or not Jewish. He's going because he's contracted to go by the line. So therefore,
right.
I don't know why the road would make any difference.
So I think the question you're raising is as follows. What is the nature of that contractual agreement? Is it the following? Is there a contract between every single passenger and the crew? Or is it a contract between a certain company who then sells their rights to every individual passenger? Now, we get into another issue. Even if I would grant you the contractual agreement is not between me and the pilot, but between the company that sold me the rights to my little cabin, It could be that that company is owned by Jewish people, in which case the contract is being signed and it commits the non-Jewish crew to work on Shabbos on behalf of the company. And that, then you get into a whole issue about what the status of a company is in halacha. And if you invite me back for a series of about 40 lectures, I could possibly answer that question. Because the status of a company in halacha is very, very complicated. I have a student of mine, this is a true story, who wanted to buy into McDonald's. He wanted to buy shares in McDonald's. And McDonald's, as you know, will make basar b'chalav, you know, meat and milk, you know, to cheeseburgers and so forth. You're not allowed to benefit from cheeseburgers. Now, he is benefiting from cheeseburgers because every time they sell a cheeseburger, he gets, you know, 0.01 cent of a cheeseburger. And there, again, you get into the issue of a company. You know, he's not buying shares as an individual. The company is really as a separate entity. That's very complicated.
You know, back in 52, I went to Japan and left from Puget Sound in Seattle. And it was very nice. The water was very calm. An hour later, we hit a storm.
Storm.
Right? And I wanted to go to the latrine, and there was a line of a mile long. And everybody was going there just to throw up.
Right.
Right? And then they were sick. They were sick for 2 weeks.
Wow. You see where the riff was talking serious business here about, you know, that's not owning Shabbos, you know.
I didn't get that sick, so I had to serve the green powdered eggs, which is disgusting.
Oh my gosh.
What about when the ship stops at a port of call on Shabbat?
Yeah, very, very complicated, very complicated.
The dogs finally on Shabbat.
Right, right. That's a serious problem. Yeah. In this essay, he doesn't even want to touch that issue because he knows that how serious it is. I would recommend that if you're embarking on a cruise, make sure you're not going to have to disembark on Shabbos. You know, but the question of disembarking on Thursday and then getting back to depart on Thursday or Friday, that I think we can be more lenient. But getting off the cruise on Shabbos, I don't know. You're going to have to. I'll send you. You have to email me, and I'll tell you all the sources on that. It's really complicated. AzariaBerzon@gmail.com.
It's interesting that you subject of davening on a cruise. Number one person, I was with three different rabbis. One said, you think about facing Yerushalayim. The second one says, you take out your iPhone, and sometimes your back is to the Aron Kodesh. And then Rabbi Reiner was told me yesterday, if you're going to turn around with your back to the Aron Kodesh, don't do it in front of the Aron Kodesh, do it to the side. So this is the way we are today.
Okay, good. Very good. You know, last week I discussed organizing a minyan on a plane, on an airplane. You're raising the issue of which way to face in the minyan on a boat, on a ship. I don't have a problem with that issue about davening on a ship. On a plane, it's a real issue. And if those who were here last week, I don't want to review the hour long discussion that we had, but we were really opposed to, in most cases, to organizing a minyan on a plane. There are just too many issues. As far as a minyan on a ship, though, I do want to tell you a story. Can I tell a story?
Yeah.
Okay, if you like stories. I'm not sure if I ever told you this story. My father, may rest in peace, was the Jewish chaplain at the Coney Island Hospital in Brooklyn, New York. And if I mention it to you, they didn't have enough funds from the from the city of New York for a separate chapel for Jewish patients. So what they had was a revolving bima. And in two out of the three of the pictures, there was somebody, you know, we won't go into detail, a Yashka Pundrick. And only when you pressed it the third time, then you saw the Aron Kodesh. So my father had a serious question, a serious issue, whether you're allowed to pray in a location that's used for idol worship. Okay, now again, as far as the Goyim is concerned, whether they're allowed to believe in the Trinity, we once discussed that. That might be Shituf, maybe it's not Avodah Zarah, but as far as we're concerned, what they're doing is Avodah Zarah. The Trinity is definitely Avodah Zarah for a Jew. So my father had this Shiloh, and he called up Izzy Klavan, and for those of you who knew Rabbi Klavan, he used to field the questions before you would ask Rav Soloveitchik. So Izzy said, Rabbi Berzon, they were very close friends, he called the vice first name, he says, Berlev, do you need a heter? do you need to get license and permission? So my father said to him desperately, because I have no place, I have no chapel for the Jewish patients. You know, here I am, I'm the chaplain, and I can't even offer the Jewish patients in Coney Island Hospital in Brooklyn, New York, a place to pray. So immediately, Rabbi Klavan says to him, you're calling the wrong, you're climbing up. When Rav Soloveitchik hears this, he's going to see red, anything that smacks of Christianity. There's no way you're going to get ahead from Rav Soloveitchik. So I recommend that you ask somebody else. So the question never actually came in front of Rav Soloveitchik, and my father at that point turned to Rav Henkin. Rav Henkin was the final posek in America at that time. And Rav Henkin heard the shaila, and he was, you know, wavering back and forth, is there any way he could come up with a permission? So he said to my father, see if you can find another four rabbis that would agree with me. I'll be at the head of the pack, and if they jump on board with me, then it's okay. And he listed four rabbonim, and these are the ones I want you to contact. And my father tediously, you know, tracked down every one of them, including Rav Moshe Feinstein was on the list. He had just arrived in America not long before that. And they all said, if Rav Henkin is behind this, we're on board. My father actually, the very day that he got the final license, he never actually relied on this, because he got a call from the city of New York, and they got new funds that came in, and they were gonna designate a special separate chapel for the Jewish patients. However, on a ship, and this is especially pressing on the, you know, for soldiers in the Navy, they don't have room for three chapels on a ship. So they have this revolving bima, as I call it. And Lamaisa, because of this effort that my father made to get this heter from five rabbanim, they rely on this heter even to this day in the Navy. So when you talk about davening on a ship, you're worried about which direction to face. I'm worried about whether you're praying in a chapel that's designated for Avodah Zarah, for the Trinity. But we might find a heter in the case of a revolving bima. Okay, what I want to do is, you know, at least introduce our next topic, which is crossing the international dateline. I don't want anyone here to ask for their money back. I'm not promising you that we will cover even the tip of the iceberg on this question. In fact, one of my father's close chums in his youth was Chaim Zimmerman. If those of you who may have heard of him, Chaim Zimmerman wrote a book literally this fat called Agan HaSar, hundreds of pages just on the issue of the dateline. And I remember my father told me that during the height of the Depression, Chaim Zimmerman asked my father to sell 5 copies of the book. The book at that time sold for $25, which is the equivalent today of probably $1,000. But Chaim Zimmerman needed a parnosa, so my father agreed to do so, and he got together his big wigs in the shul, and he was able to sell 5 copies. I have a copy of the book. And frankly speaking, I understand about this much of the book. It's very, very complicated. My question to you is the following. Why does the halacha care at all about the international dateline? The international dateline, which we'll soon see what it's all about, has nothing to do with halacha. This was an agreement of the nations of the world. Why should it have any halachic bearing? If I could reformulate my question, does the halacha recognize the concept of a dateline, which means that you cross the dateline? Again, it depends in which direction you're crossing the dateline. You're either going to turn your clock one day ahead or one day back. Where is the halachic basis for that at all? So what I'm going to try to do now, and again, I'm saying a kapitel tilim here that Hashem should help me, because it's very complicated, to try to explain why halacha must recognize a dateline. It doesn't mean that halacha will recognize the international dateline, you know, starting with one city and then moving towards the west. But why does halacha need a dateline? So I'm going to try to, what do you say?
Shabbat.
Exactly. For sure, Bichlal Shabbat. So I'm going to try to explain why. L'chora, let's say I'll choose a city at random. Let's say I'm in New York City. And it's Thursday night. Okay? Now, it's midnight Thursday night. in halacha, and even in second, third, you know, past midnight, you know, it's 12:01 a.m., that's already the next day. So you've gone from Thursday to Friday. So now in New York, past midnight, and therefore it is what? It is Friday. Now, if I'm in Chicago, the sun hasn't set yet. You know, it sets an hour earlier than it does in New York. So then, at 1 a.m. in Chicago, it's going to become midnight. So in New York, it's already midnight. It's already the next day. But in Chicago, it's 1 hour earlier. Then we go, let's say, California. So California is going to be 3 hours earlier. And then we go to Hawaii. And Hawaii is going to, once you're traveling west, it takes longer, so to speak, for the sun to set. So now the problem is the following. I keep going from one place to the other until finally I circulate the entire globe, the entire earth, and I'm back in New York. Well, what day of the week is it? I mean, I started on a Friday. I now have gone all the way around the world. Every place that I went to the west was 1 hour earlier. So I get earlier and earlier and earlier. Until finally, 24 hours later, I'm back in New York. If I'm back in New York 24 hours later, is it Friday or is it Shabbos? So you might say, well, 24 hours have passed since midnight on Thursday night. Then for sure, it's Shabbos. But if you apply that rule, you're going to be stuck. Eventually, you're going to have a very confusing situation that's almost impossible. Because you keep getting earlier and earlier and earlier as you travel west. So at what point are you going to say that you finally are on the same day as it is in New York? You don't know exactly where that point is. I'll give you a simile. Imagine two people that are standing on the same spot. Okay, the same location on the face of the globe. Okay, we'll call them Reuven and Shimon, just to make up names, right? Reuven is traveling west, which means that it's getting earlier and earlier. Shimon is traveling east, so it's getting later and later. Now, they both travel around the globe. At some moment in time, Reuven and Shimon are going to meet on the other side of the globe. So what happens? Reuven is 1 day before Shimon. And they're both in the same exact location. How could that be? Reuven and Shimon are shaking hands. For Reuven, it's Thursday. And for Shimon, it's Friday. Why? Because Shimon went to the east and Reuven went to the west. Or whatever I said before. It doesn't matter. Right? So that the one who goes east is 1 day ahead of the one who went west. And yet they met at the same exact point. How could it be that two people are standing at the same point, and for one person it's Friday, and for the other person it's Saturday? There's something fluky in the system, because, again, you know, at the time of Chazal, they didn't have this problem. You know, everybody lived in the upper hemisphere. That's where the Yishuv was. That's where the civilized world was. And people basically all lived within a certain circumscribed area. But today, we have so much travel around the world that these issues have come up. So what I gave you today, if you have 6 pages, which means 3 pages double-sided, is an essay by a young man by the name of David Palmer. And he wrote this essay about the dateline in, you know, with advice and guidance from Rav Herschel Schechter. So, for example, if you take a look on the second side of the first page, which might say 61 on the top right, you'll see that at some point, when a person is traveling towards, let's say, the west, he's going to finally be to the east. Do you follow me? Because the world is round. So if you're traveling to the west, at some point you circulate the entire globe and you end up on the west. So wait a minute. The west is ahead of the east. You've been traveling east. I'm sorry. I meant whatever I said, forget about it. You're traveling west. So if you're traveling west, it's getting earlier and earlier. Correct? Because the sun is setting later and later. But at some point, you reach a point which is to the west, which means that you're ahead. I meant to say to the east, I'm sorry. I'll get it straight. This reminds me of all those posters that fell on the floor. You know what I'm saying? Okay, we'll get it right, right? So if you're traveling to the east, right, the sun is setting earlier and earlier, correct? So it's getting... Right, I'm sorry, let me get this straight. The sun is setting later and later, right, when you're traveling to the east, okay? When you're traveling to the east, right? The sun is setting earlier and earlier. Did I get that right? Okay, the sun is setting earlier and earlier. So now, what it means is that as you're traveling east, then your clock is in effect, or your date is now getting later and later. But if you're traveling to the east, then your date is getting earlier and earlier. Very strange, because at some point you meet around the globe, and what happens? You're both in the same place, but the fellow who is going east is ahead, and presumably by a full 24 hours, of the fellow who traveled to the west, who's got it earlier. So how do we solve this problem? At some point, you're going to have to tell me that it's no longer west, and it became east. Again, if you start with New York, in other words, at some point in the globe, you have ceased going west, and now you're to the east of New York, if you follow what I mean. And that would mean that your clock, your date has to be one day ahead. Now again, this is a tremendous halachic issue, as you mentioned before so well, that we have a Shabbat issue. Because if you're going to change the date by one day, the nafkamina, the difference is going to be, when is it Shabbos for you? I mean, there are some poskim who are so perplexed by this question that they said that wherever you are on the face of the globe, you should count 7 days and observe the 7th day of Shabbos. That's unacceptable. You've got to have some objective date and figure out what it is. So if you take a look on the fifth line or so on page 61, he writes, we derive two conclusions. First of all, the need for a dateline is real. We really have to have a dateline. But second, the location of the dateline is arbitrary. We don't have any halachic guidance here to tell us at what point do you, let's say if you're traveling west, at what point do you belong to the east, and therefore you are on the next date, and that instead of it being Friday for you, it's Saturday for you. Where? At what point did I circulate the earth? You know, I went to the point where I now end up to the east of New York, if you follow me, and I'm no longer to the west of New York. And I have to turn my clock one day ahead, and that's going to be enough to be in Shabbos. And some poskim said, well, let's go according to the international dateline. And this was rejected with tremendous, what word am I looking for? Almost with a fierce, intolerable anger. It can't be that just because the nations of the world decided that this is going to be the international dateline, that therefore the halach has to comply with that. There must be some sort of halachic guidance as to at what point you've traveled so far, let's say west, that you now have to jump one day ahead of yourself because you're really on the east. So at what point?
Not up until maybe 250 years ago, 300 years ago. The concept, no Jew.
Right, there was no such thing as travel at that time to that extent. Everybody lived within close proximity. That's what he writes here at the end of this section on page 61. He says that this never came up for many thousands of years, because in order to meet, someone had to circumnavigate the world, which didn't happen until after the Mid Ages. So after the Mid Ages, let's say 500 years ago, this problem became a problem. And the question is, how do we decide at what point he's no longer to the west, he's already on the east? Meaning, he's crossed the dateline. Where is this dateline? So if you'll fast forward for a moment, how are we doing on the clock? Okay, we'll give it another 5 minutes to let's try page 63, and you'll see that there is one single halachic text, a Gemara tucked away in the middle or towards the end of Rosh Hashanah, that may give us the answer to this question. Okay, so let's see if we can understand this Gemara. Now, again, we're not going to enter into Rashi's interpretation of the Gemara, because Rashi's interpretation of the Gemara sheds absolutely no light on our subject. But we're going to take the Baal HaMor. Remember I mentioned to the Baal HaMor before about why you don't embark on a ship in the last 3 days before Shabbos. Okay. The Gemara says in Masechta Rosh Hashanah that if, let's say, the Edim, the witnesses, come in to testify that they saw the new moon, will that day be declared as Rosh Chodesh, right? It's possible that the Edim came at some point in time, which was too late in the day, to announce that day as Rosh Chodesh, in which case we'll have to wait another day, and tomorrow will be Rosh Chodesh. So what the Gemara wants to know, according to Baal HaMor, what is the cutoff point? When did this new moon appear? And again, we're talking about Eretz Yisrael now, because, you know, Kiddush HaChodesh, determining the new moon, depends upon Israel. So the Gemara comes to the conclusion that it all depends upon noon, which means the following: that if the new moon appeared before 12 noon, which is called Chatzos HaYom, then there's enough left to the day to determine that this day is Rosh Chodesh. If the new moon appears after noon, after 12 noon, then we have to delay Rosh Chodesh for another day.
Is it halachic noon or
no? Halachic noon means you take a 24-hour period from starting with sunrise, and you figure out when would be 6 hours after sunrise. That's called halachic noon. Okay, now add that 6 hours in a perfect day to the 6 hours of night, so it means you've divided the day into two halves of 12 hours each. When you are 12 hours into the day, and then you saw the moon, the new moon at 12:01, it's too late for Rosh Chodesh. So the Baal HaMor says, why? What happens at noon? Why is that the cutoff point? And they can no longer declare that day as Rosh Chodesh because the new moon was seen after 12 noon. 12:01, we'll call it. Oh. Comes along the Baal HaMor, and he says the following: that noon in Israel, you'll see this on the bottom of page 63, is the latest time for any locale that has not yet begun the new day. Okay, it means that there is going to be some location on the face of the earth which has not yet entered into that day. So that Bezdin, the courts can declare this as Rosh Chodesh because there's some place, we'll call it X, on the face of the globe where that day, it doesn't matter what day of the week it is, has not yet begun, which means that there's some place which could observe or experience Rosh Chodesh as a full 24-hour period. Okay. Now, noontime is 18 hours after nightfall. Now, how do we get that? Because from night until until sunrise is going to be 12 hours. And then from sunrise until noon is another 6 hours. So you add 12 to 6 and you end up with 18 hours. Okay. So that means that noon is 18 hours after nightfall. And following this logic, it means there's some location on the face of the globe where that day has not yet begun. Which would mean that if you go 18 hours to the west of Israel, where the day is early, if you follow what I mean. In other words, the sunset is later. So as the clock gets earlier, you can move a full 18 hours to the west and get to a point in which the day has not yet begun. That means that if you would go 1 inch further, meaning you're beyond the 18 hours to the west, then it's no longer that day. Well, what happened over here? What happens? I cross over the 18 hours to the west of Israel, and now I'm saying it's no longer that day. Why is it no longer that day? Says the Baal Amar, because once you cross the 18 hours, then you're on the east, and then you're one day ahead. We need Rosh Chodesh to coincide with that day in which they saw the moon. So let me just again summarize, if you can, this Gemara Rosh Hashanah according to Baal Amar. This is fascinating because this is going to tell us exactly where the halachic dateline is. That halachic dateline is going to be 18 hours to the west of Israel. Why? Because from noon going backwards, we have 18 hours from the beginning of that day. There's got to be a locale on the face of the earth where it's not yet the beginning of the day at noon, meaning let's say 1 minute before noon. So it's 11:59.9 in Israel. And now we go 18 hours to the west. If we travel 18 hours to the west, that day has not begun. Well, what happens if we go 18 hours plus 1 minute to the west? At that point you turn your clock one day ahead. And we need that this day be celebrated, be organized as Rosh Chodesh. Now, based on this, the Rishonim establish that the dateline, in halachic terms, is 90% east of Israel. Right? Because again, if you're talking 18 hours at a 24-hour day, correct? So what percentage do you have? 3/4, am I right? So if you take 360 degrees and you divide it into 4 quarters, right? Each quarter is 90 degrees. Once you've gone 90 degrees to the east, then, to the east of Israel, of Jerusalem, right? At that point, 90 degrees to the east is going to be, which we would have said is 6 hours ahead of Israel. No. At that point, you're going to fast forward your clock, so to speak. I don't know what the word clock is, not good. But anyway, the date that you're... What are you saying?
Your wristwatch.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you're going to change your wristwatch by 24 hours, and you're going to be one day ahead. So again, let's just summarize. If you're going to the west of Israel for 18 hours, then you're at a location in which the day has not yet begun. Whatever that day is irrelevant to us. Again, that's the day in which they saw the new moon. Let's call it a Sunday. It's irrelevant to us. If you go back a full 18 hours to your west, then that day, Sunday, has not yet commenced. It hasn't begun yet. And therefore, since it's 11:59 in Jerusalem, I can still be Makadish the Chodesh and consider today as Rosh Chodesh, because again, we found one location on the face of the earth where that day, call it Sunday, has not yet commenced, hasn't begun yet. Where is it? And the Gemara says it's 18 hours, right? Because the 18 hours reflects the time from nightfall until noon. 18 hours to the west of Jerusalem. So once up till 18 hours to the west of Jerusalem, we have what? We have the beginning of the day. In other words, the day is getting, you know, earlier and earlier and earlier, right? The sun is setting later and later and later. And therefore, it's, you know, the clock is an hour earlier. We can pull the clock back to the beginning of that day, 18 hours to the west of Israel. Now, on the eastern side of Jerusalem, here we have 90 degrees. So once we pass the 90 degrees west of Jerusalem, we already have to fast forward our clock by a day. And they are going to be a day ahead of us. This is going to be the opinion of what I call the majority of poskim, that we're going to look for a longitude that's 90 degrees to the east of Israel, and that is going to be the point of the halachic dateline. So that means if I travel 90 degrees east of Jerusalem, then I forward my day from whatever it is, from Sunday to Monday, or in the most halachic significance, from Friday to Shabbos. Now, the problem is that the international dateline is way to the west of that 90 degree. And next week, well, I don't know when I'll be here again, but next time we get together, I'll show you on the maps that there's going to be an entire section which, according to the international dateline, belongs to one day, and according to the halachic deadline, belongs to another day. And this is going to be very odd. And we're going to soon see that in Japan, for example, which is 90 degrees east of Jerusalem and more, we're going to have a situation in which Sunday becomes Saturday. And it really becomes very complicated to tell the Jews of Japan that they have to organize Shabbos a different day than Saturday. So for the Goyim, it's Saturday, and for the Jews, it's already Shabbos. Very, very strange. So again, all this was an introduction, which I think I accomplished more than I expected to. The international dateline, you'll see, is 180 degrees from Greenwich, England, and that is not the deadline, the dateline for halacha. So there's going to be a discrepancy between the international dateline and the halachic dateline. So we'll stop here. And I'll wish everyone a great week. Again, this was just to get you a little bit oriented in the issue of the halachic dateline, which is a very, very complicated issue, and I'm just understating it when I say that. Right? Everyone should be well.